great.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Sheila. It's a real privilege for me to be here this morning. Some of you who got here fairly early this morning for the meeting saw Jim Hawkins down front already seated real early, and I'm sure you thought he was there because he had some tickets he wanted to sell. Truth of the matter was, Jim knows me, and he was down here praying. I can't tell you, pardon me, what it means to me to have been invited to do this. I feel a lot of gratitude for that. Let me give you a quick apology before I go on. Let me back up to the beginning. My name is Jim Barksdale, and I'm an Al-Anon. Anybody that talks as much as I do, or as I say sometimes, sort of runs off at the mouth, is bound to say something sometime they ought not to. So if I should say anything that's the slightest bit offensive to anybody in here, let me apologize now, because it won't be intentional, I assure you. Well, Kevin's been doing it to me all his life. He's done it again. Last May, he calls me and gives me this story about how at Mont Eagle, and those of you who don't know, I've been up here many, many times, but it's been several years. He said, you know, we're going to have something, we're planning something a little different for our May meeting. Bear in mind, that's another year away. And I said, what's that, son? He said, well, he said the board has decided they want to have a father-son combination talk, you know, AA Al-Anon. I said, great, who's it going to be? Now, how many of you have had the experience of somebody asking you to do something 12 months down the road? You know, I thought about it, and I thought, well, after all, that's a good bunch of folks up there. They're nice people. They deserve a good speaker. Then as the time starts growing closer and it gets down, first 6 months is okay, you know. Then it gets down to about 6 months to go, and you begin to think, now, wait a minute. What was that date, and what did I agree to do? So not only did he get me into it that way, then he goes first last night and leaves me having to follow that. I threatened last night, and Tom told me I couldn't. I threatened to turn it back over to him this morning and let him finish what he started. Like most of you within this fellowship here, I guess I'm just going to have to throw caution to the wind and count on some real good friends to be very patient with me, because as I look out here, you know, I see some folks that have known me many, many, many years. Phil Mack, the longest of anybody in here, outside of Kevin, and Phil has always told me a lot of things. I'll share some of that with you. Dottie, I've known almost that long. Tara told you last night about how long she and I had known each other and where we go back to. And I was talking with her last night after the meeting, and I said, Tara, I said, when you and I were first together, working together in the office, you were about 3 or 4 months sober. I was still dealing with the other side of the problem. Neither one of us had enough sense to come in out of the rain. We had a real difficult time. She and I had a number of AA Al-Anon meetings in my office. And then I remember, too, David sitting back there in the back, David B. And I don't know if he even remembers this for sure or not, but the first meeting I ever went to, Phil carried me to a meeting in Atlanta. And I thought we were going to, you know, I knew just enough about the program of Alcoholics Anonymous to know that there were such things as open meetings, closed meetings, and all that sort of thing. I went to what Phil never did tell me. I assumed it was an open meeting. Well, it wasn't. you know, it was a closed meeting of AA, and he carried me in there, and David was chairing the meeting that night. Nobody said a word about me coming in there. I guess they looked at me and said, that poor sick so-and-so, if he ain't one of us, he ought to be. So, so they just let me in. Then I was visiting with Frank last night after the meeting and before too. And, you know, I can go back to so much of Kevin's story last night. But I remember those times that Frank and I were talking about him just coming into the program. I haven't forgotten that. And as I visited around with others last night, Terry and I talked a while, a number of us, I had the good fortune, and I think it was good fortune, to share in the stories of watching a bunch of these folks, some of the finest people I've ever met in my life, get their lives in order. Now, you can't get it much better than that. I'm going to try to be real brief on some of the early part of this, because just to sort of set the stage for you a little bit. I grew up originally in the western part of the state of Tennessee. Very loving, caring family. Just my sister and I and my mother and dad. And I found out real early things don't always go real well for you. I was 5 years older than my sister. At age 15, I watched her life drain away and held her hand and found out that life doesn't always go the way you want it to, so you need things to hold on to. You need a faith. You need something to believe in. I made some early commitments because our household was one that we were very closely allied with the church. So I made a commitment to my religion real early, and this is not going to be a sermon, y'all. But I want to talk about commitments because I think that's important. And some of you I know can identify with what I'm going to say here. I grew up at a time when if you had to put something in writing, then it probably wasn't worth having anyway. You know, you operated pretty much, I heard my dad say many, many times, my word is my bond. So I watched him in business back at a time when you had the old crank telephone or you had the one where you just picked up the receiver and Central came on. And we live in this real small town in West Tennessee, and I'd watch him get on the phone and call. He was in the automobile business, so I'm just a used car salesman at heart, y'all. I really am. Watch him pick up that telephone, call a contact up in Michigan or Illinois or somewhere up in the country, and he'd ask them what they had to sell in the way of automobiles, and they'd give him a list. Say, well, I've got a 40 model Ford two-door, a 39 Chevy four-door, and he'd list off these cars, and then he'd say, well, what do you want for them? And they'd give him a figure, and he'd look at it and think a minute and say, okay, I'll take them. Now I'll call you when I get my drivers together to come get them. Hang up a telephone, pick it up again, call a dealer friend down in Louisiana, and say, Terrell, here's what I got. Read off that same list of cars, add a little for his trouble, and Terrell would say, sounds good to me, CA, send them to me. You know, that's the way business was conducted. If you think about it a little bit, there's still a good bit of that that goes on, maybe not quite in that fashion, but there's still a lot of it. Most of us, if we couldn't commit to each other back and forth on the telephone, whether it's a business or a personal matter, probably couldn't get around too easily. Then there's something else I think maybe some of you can identify with me. I grew up in the late years of the Depression. It left me with some lasting impressions that I never have been able to shake. For example, it's the hardest thing in the world for me, and I travel a great deal in my job. It's very hard for me to get used to going to a motel or hotel, spending 2 or 3 days, and not carrying the soap home with me. You know. book matches. Of course, nobody's got them anymore. But I used to pick them up every time I got a chance. Kevin knows about all this, you know, he's watched me do it. I finally got to where I can walk away and leave a little soap at the hotel now. But that's the kind of background I came from. I've told Kevin these stories so many times, he'll have to go to sleep over here in a little bit. But I remember as about a 7 or 8 year old. Oh, incidentally, I had my first job at 7. He always enjoys me telling him that one. But the truth of the matter is, he probably had his first one before he was 7. But anyway, I worked for a milk dairy route from the time I was 7 years old. I worked there off and on until I got through college. So I got a great deal of influence out of the folks that I worked with there. A lot of things had happened to me real early. But be that as it may, I came on up through a period of time that I want to share with you just a little bit about, because I think this sets the stage too. When I was growing up, nobody knew anything about, at least not around us, knew anything about alcoholism. If you'd have said alcoholism or somebody's an alcoholic, nobody would know what you're talking about. Now, I don't mean to imply there wasn't a lot of drinking going on, but what we said was, and within my family, lots of it, what we said was, well, old so-and-so is bad to drink. And I can remember also very well that I didn't have to have the elders and the older folks in the family explain anything to me. It was an accepted fact that they weren't bad folks. They just couldn't do anything about it, and you didn't know why. I thought a little about some of the things Kevin said last night, and he alluded to walking out to the edge of the property here. One of my cousins, every time there was a family gathering, he got absolutely rip-roaring drunk. He couldn't come to the family reunion. But what he did do was he came as close as he could get. He'd hide out in back of the house wherever we were, or he'd find a tree to hide behind. And finally, eventually, because all of us kids knew he was out there somewhere, you know, we'd get out there playing around and somebody'd find Cousin Lloyd and go down and tell someone, whisper to some of the older folks, Lloyd's out there behind that big tree, and the answer was, let him alone. Another one, and this one is one of my and Kevin's favorite people in my family. You know, everybody's got a real character in the family somewhere. Well, in ours, it was Cousin Jamie. Now, Cousin Jamie was bad to drink. He was a binge drinker, and I mean, when I say binge, I really mean binge, because Kevin and I were kidding about it last night. Jamie would get on a bender sometime about mid-December, and it'd run till well after Christmas. And then when he got sober, he'd tell he'd tell Mammy and Pap that he wasn't going to drink no more till the 4th of July. And he wouldn't. But bless your soul, watch out come the 4th of July, because he's going to tie on a good one. This was, again, remember, this is back in the 30s. We had things like old Model A cars that had solid glass windshields that weren't safety glass. Well, Jamie and one of his friends were out one night, and he wrecked his Model A, and he went through the windshield on that thing. Well, you can imagine what it did to his face. They carried him to a little clinic about 16 miles from home. Some of you, I know at least one of you knows where Paris is. There was a little clinic up there. It didn't have any hospitals. Carried him to this clinic, and he's stretched out up there, and the doctor at the clinic wasn't known to be the most sympathetic, empathetic person in the world. And he looked over there, and said, well, there ain't no need me fooling away any time with him because he's going to die anyway. And Jamie, wearing a pair of old bib overalls like he always did, managed to get that snap open on those overalls, reached in there and came out with a roll of bills about like this. So he was early in his bender. You'd know that immediately. Laid that roll of bills down over there, and he said, now, Doc, never you mind about what you think. You start sowing. And if you run out of money before you get through, just keep on sowing because Pap will bring some more when he comes. He sewed him up. Kevin knows what kind of job it looked like that Jamie had done on his face. This doctor didn't waste a whole lot of time with him because he wasn't going to live anyway, you know. So he went around the rest of his life with some of the worst scars you ever saw on his face, but he made good storytelling, and Jamie didn't seem to mind at all. And he'd tell that story with the greatest of glee. He lived through it, only to die much later of the disease of alcoholism. After a number of years around this program, meeting and talking with lots of folks like the good folks in this room, I finally reached a conclusion that there was one other very bad alcoholic in my family that I had never really been able to recognize that that's what it was, and that was my dad. And that only came to me in about the last 10 years. But there's absolutely no question that that was the case. Now, with all this kind of background, I'll digress here for just a minute to tell you that one of the things that Phil Mack has always told me, after he got to know me real well, and he and I had known each other in a working relationship for many years, but after he got to know me real well, he said, Jim, it's my confirmed opinion that you're on the wrong side of this program. Well, I don't know how you got there. And I said, well, I don't either, you know. But whichever side I'm on, as long as I'm here, you know. I've heard so many AA stories, and I've heard all of you say, well, look, if you don't know when you had your last drink, you hadn't had it yet. Well, I can tell you within a week of when I had my last one, because it scared me to death, and I decided, hey, I'm not going to take the risk anymore. It's just not worth it. I finished growing up at home and went to college, on into the Navy. During my college years, I had met and married the very lovely lady that many of you know as my wife, Virginia. We had three sons, 3 years apart, so it happened pretty fast for us after we were married. We had one born right after I went into the Navy, not too long afterward, the oldest one. Then we had one born back in Tennessee when we were back there for a brief period of time, and then Kevin came along after we moved to Birmingham. I had a very busy, demanding job, so I have to credit Kevin's mom with most of the raising of the boys. And despite some of the problems we encountered along the way, I think she did a terrific job. But we had a very close relationship, and I do want to tell you that, you know, and I'm sure you already know this, but you never know what it is that influences or affects somebody. You never know what people are paying attention to. I knew what was important to me, but I didn't really know maybe exactly what was important to Kevin. But he told me not too terribly long ago, he said, you know, one of the things that meant the most to me in my growing up years was that with as busy as you were, as much traveling as you were doing, you never missed a high school wrestling match in which I participated. I didn't think I had, but he said, no, you didn't. Now, the closest I came was they were wrestling a team down about 90 miles south of Birmingham, and I was traveling down in South Alabama, and I cut loose from wherever I was, and I don't know how fast I drove, but anyway, I drove into Prattville, Alabama, found that gymnasium, I walked in the door, and I do remember this, that when I walked in the door, Kevin was down there pacing back and forth behind the mat. He was two matches away from his match. But anyway, I didn't know this sort of thing had that much significance to him. In fact, there were some times along in there where I wondered if he cared one way or the other, whether I showed up or whether I didn't at anything. But anyway, that relationship was very important, and we maintained it right along, except for some times like he talked about last night. With all of this going on, a very busy family life with three boys that were involved in an awful lot of things. When we started dealing with the problem of what I pretty early on determined at that point was alcoholism, I simply could not understand. I didn't know how to deal with it at all. I started seeking answers. Here I was. First of all, I'm the father. I'm the head of this household. Do you mean to tell me that I can't control my family? That these boys are not going to do things exactly the way I tell them? In addition to that, we're talking about a kid who never had been a problem. I never corrected him much. Never had to apply much discipline. He knew what he was supposed to do, and he did it. So all of a sudden, we're getting hit with this, and I didn't know what to do with it. I went about looking for answers, and I was alternatingly told, depending on who I talked with. For example, I went to a psychiatrist. I think Kevin had gotten to her first, because her advice to me was, "You're being too tight on this kid. Back away and let him have some room." Then I went to see a counselor who hears the story and says, "Sir, you better go home and take charge." I thought that's what I was trying to do, you know. Incidentally, you remember from Kevin's story last night, he was talking about the day when he and his friend got up and walked out of class and the principal kept them and managed to keep them in school. That was the morning Kevin's mother and I were visiting with the counselor. I had left word where we could be reached, and we got a phone call in the midst of that counseling session. Says, "I think you better come home." I'm grateful that today I can laugh about that. But Kevin was a real hard worker. Everybody loved him. I remember when he was in grade school, we were looking at some of the papers he was bringing home, and he wasn't bringing home any bad ones. He was making good grades, but he wasn't making outstanding grades, and I knew he was capable of it. So his mother and I decided, well, we're having an open house at school tonight, so we're going to visit with the teacher and say, what's the problem with Kevin? Well, as far as she was concerned, there wasn't any problem with Kevin, and when she found out we were a little bit worried about his grades, they automatically just went up. So when he tells you in his talk or in his conversation with you that he could con you, I guarantee you he could con you. He was good. Phil used to tell me, he said, "Well, Jim, don't worry about it. You know, if you know he's doing it to you, he's not conning you." I'm still not sure about that one, Phil. I guess if I had a title for my talk, it would probably be just a single word: miracles. Because I observed a lot of miracles, both before and after this program. I credit those miracles to my higher power, the God of my understanding, whom I call God. Kevin was telling you the story last night about that Camaro that he and I were going to repair. I do wish you could have seen that car. That was one miracle. But he forgot to tell you a couple more. So I want to be sure and post you on those. Now this one, he didn't even mention. Well, he and I have talked a little since last night's talk, but this one he didn't even mention, didn't think of, I don't think. But one night I was working late at the office. We were going to be there until midnight or after. And he knew it. He knew where I was. He had his first car. He was out running around, and he got pretty blown out of the saddle. I get a phone call because he knew where I was. So when the deputy sheriff picked him up, he said, "Well, here's where you can get my dad." So he called me, and he said, "Now, Mr. Barksdale, don't get real upset because your son's fine." And he said, "He hadn't caused me a bit of problem in the world. He's sitting here. Everything's fine. Just need you to come get him." And he said, "Oh, by the way," he said, "I picked him up walking down Valley Avenue." And he said, "The reason he's walking is his car quit running on him." And he said, "It's a God's blessing it did, because he sure wasn't in shape to be driving it." So I go out and pick him up, carry him back to the office. Next morning, real early, I run down to a little independent shop we used and threw the car key to the owner, and I said, "WM, when y'all get time this morning, I want you to send a wrecker up, pick up Kevin's car." I told him where it was. I said, "I don't know what happened to it. Fuel pump's gone, something." So about the middle of the morning, I get a phone call, and WM says, "Jim, I don't know." He said, we pulled that car in, and said, "We pulled it into a stall over here," and said, "I told Jimmy to check it out," and said, "He walked over there, got behind the wheel, turned on the key, the car started." He said, "We can't find anything wrong with it." I don't know, you can call it what you want to. I think it was a miracle. Another one, you remember the car he told you about that he wrecked several more times after the Camaro. Well, this one then, this was the windup of this last one. He hit a power pole one night in Homewood. Now, I can tell you for sure that if that power pole had been a solid, good, normal Alabama power pole, we wouldn't be talking about Kevin today, at least not in the living context. That pole was sitting there supporting all those wires, and when he hit that thing with that Mustang he was driving, he broke that post off right at the ground. It was rotten. It brought all the wires down around him, all of them sparking and everything else, and of course he was a little out of it by that time, and the first thing he remembered was that policeman standing out there saying, "Son, don't move. You know, don't get out until we get these wires killed." So there were some double miracles, I think, that night. Anyway, in addition to that, this is a very minor one, doesn't amount to that much, but I was told that, among other things, we were going to need to pay for that power pole to get it back up. You know, I kept watching. I called the power company, acknowledged responsibility, said, "You get it up, let me know." They didn't even put the pole back up. They just stretched the wires on over to the next pole, and that was the end of that. Every once in a while, I go by over in Homewood just to see, and there's that same hole over there where they never put that pole back into it. When I called Phil, and you see, we've all got selective memories, I called Phil to tell him about this situation that I was dealing with and asking for advice. Phil says that what I did was that I outlined to him the situation about this friend of mine who had a son who had a problem. Now, I promise you, I do not remember it that way. I thought I called him and said, "Phil, I got a problem." He said, "No, that wasn't the way it was." But anyway, he told me about the treatment center that he felt at that time was the best one. And those of you who would remember back in those years, there weren't many. But anyway, I ended up with Kevin in the car with me. After that, I have to tell you that particular accident that he had with the car, this was before the one where he hit the pole. He's telling you about his curfew at night and coming home. I think there was a little more to it than that. But that night when I ended up about half a mile from the house, directly across from our church, I go up to pick up Kevin, and he and I looked at his car the next day. We could clearly identify at least two collisions, and we think three, that he had trying to get home. Now, the curfew might have been what was bringing him home. I always felt like there was a little bit more involved in it than that. But in any event, that was sort of the, you know, we decided, hey, we got a problem. Got to do something. I called Phil. Phil called the treatment center. They said, yeah, we got room. Kevin and I took off to Atlanta. Phil met us that night when we got there. We spent the night in a motel in Atlanta and then on out to the treatment center the next day. I'm not going to dwell on this because if I do, I'll have to quit talking, and I don't want to do that because I'm not through yet. But we got out there and got all the formalities taken care of, and when I walked out that door, of course, Phil had assured me, Jim, they know what they're doing, and I'm going to be real close to him and real close to the situation, and for that I'll be eternally grateful. But when I walked out that door and headed back out to that little blue car I had driven over there, it was sitting by the curb, sort of out by itself in the parking lot. I sure was glad, because I had to sit down on that curb and bawl for about 10 minutes before I could get my face straight enough and my mind clear enough to get in the car and drive home. I say that only because I want to stress to him again how much I cared. I don't think that's necessary. When I got back home, Phil had recognized, and I told him, I said, Phil, I got to have some help. He said, I know it. I'm fixing to work on some for you. So he called a fellow whom many of you in here know. He's no longer with us, and I regret that very much because I loved him. He called a fellow named Harold Rourke, who was at that time living in Birmingham, and he told Harold about me, and he said he needs some help. Harold lived on the opposite side of town. It took him about an hour to drive out to my area. But he met me to go to my very first Al-Anon meeting in Birmingham. He went to the AA meeting, introduced me and got me into the Al-Anon meeting. We came back out after the meeting. We stood in the parking lot and talked for an hour and a half, 2 hours. I'd never met Harold before. But he was sharing with me, and it was coming down like rain in a thunderstorm, because he was covering me up with it. And what he was covering me up with was love, support, and caring. We finished talking, decided we both had to get to work the next morning, so we better part company. And when Harold reached over and gave me this big bear hug and told me he loved me, I knew I was where I needed to be. I had also walked into that first step meeting at night with two ladies who absolutely convinced me beyond any shadow of a doubt that I was where I needed to be. Hey, you know, there were some good things for us guys around Al-Anon a number of years ago that don't exist too much anymore, but I was an oddity. Weren't many males in Al-Anon, you know. I'd get into these Al-Anon meetings, and there'd be 10, 15, 20 women and me, you know. Now, I don't know about most of you guys. I enjoyed that. That was a lot of fun. It also indicted us males severely for the fact that there weren't any more males there who cared, you know, enough to do this. It taught me a lot, and I'm sure glad to see that it changed. But I did enjoy some of that. I conducted a lot of first step meetings and beginners meetings when I first came. One of the reasons I did was because, you know, you needed to tell people, hey, you got to learn to live one day at a time. Well, I wasn't too good at that, but I said, now, if you want to talk about an hour at a time or a minute at a time and weave them into days, now I can do that. So that helped me a lot, spending a lot of time doing that. I said Kevin had done it to me again. The very first talk I was asked to make of a formal nature was in this NA Naranon group that he told you about last night. First time, other than that, I'd been in some discussion meetings where somebody asked me to comment for 2 or 3 or 4 or 5 minutes at a time, but this time they asked me to speak, and it was an anniversary for them. Going to be real well attended. Well, I accepted fairly early. We start moving down toward time, and wouldn't you know, just two or three days before the meeting, Kevin had a gigantic slip. And here I am, ready to go make my talk. Well, I did it anyway, since that didn't really have anything to do with it anyway. The miracles of this program are, though, what's really been important to me. I've got a lot of good things to be thankful for, and I think most of them, truly, came at least as partially as a result of this program. We brought a representative sampling of my three very lovely, very wonderful daughters-in-law. I've got two more that I'm very grateful for, whom I love very much. Virginia and I have five grandchildren. Now, I know a lot of you have grandchildren, so you probably say, well, no big deal. But, hey, these are my grandchildren. Big difference. Not long ago, my oldest son was talking to his 7-year-old little girl, and he was having a little bit of a hard time out of her. And he finally said, "Sissy, do you not care what I think?" And she said, "Uh-uh." He said, "Well, do you care what Mama thinks?" "No." "Well, how about Grandmother and Granddaddy?" "No." He said, "Well, Sissy, who do you care about?" And she said, "God and me." You know, she might fit into this fellowship. I think, among other things, the good things that have come to me are, first, getting to meet all of you. Finest bunch of folks that have been around in my life. My Kevin's middle brother is a very, very active in his church. He's very active in everything that they do. He's active in a lot of different programs. But he has told me repeatedly, and I know he's told Kevin, you know, if we could just bring into our church what you folks have got in AA, we'd turn this world over, you know. If we had this kind of love and this kind of caring. So for that, I'm extremely grateful. The bonding that went on and continues to go on today, and I talk about this in a personal nature of just the two of us, since that's who you know the most. It also involves other members of the family, but the bonding that went on between Kevin and I and continues to go on today. I'm close to all three of my sons. I love them very dearly, and they do me, I think. But the bonding that went on between us, we occasionally tell each other that there's not much we could face we hadn't already faced together, you know. Now, he said last night that somebody said maybe I was standing down there holding the gate of hell open for him to get back out. The worst part is I think I probably held it open to help him get in there. He and I finally decided at one point that we almost loved each other to death before it was over. And we did a lot of those things. I did a lot of those things in the name of love. Another good thing that came to me was a program in Birmingham that some of you are very familiar with. Jim H. is very familiar with it because he was on the original board of directors. Is the Fellowship House, that halfway house in Birmingham that I'm very proud of being on that board of directors, serving with some of the finest folks that I've ever known. Jim D., whom many of you know, and I understand Jim hadn't been up here in the last couple of years, but many of you know him. Jim D. worked over there for a while, and he used to kid about what a fine job we did with him working over there and me as president of the board for a couple of years. I don't think he ever said the rest of it, and I didn't either much because it scared us to death every time we thought about it. Those of you who are familiar with the program and with the house over there, it's actually separated into three buildings. Well, one of those buildings was about to fall down while I was president. We decided we've got to do something. And we got to make a leap of faith here. We don't have the money, but we got to do something to get this building down and get it back where we can use it. So we decided, and the board voted with our leadership, to demolish that building and put a new one up. We took the building down, and then we set about trying to find a way to rebuild the building. And lo and behold, we found out that the building we had there was grandfathered, and we could no longer meet the code. We couldn't meet anything to put that building back up. Well, Jim D. and I would look at each other and say, we're going to go down in history. We're going to be known as those two crazy guys that helped the Fellowship House demolish this building with no way to put it back up. We managed to get clearance with a lot of begging and pleading to put that building back up. It's standing today, housing a lot more folks than the old one did, but we sure had some anxious moments there. Over the years, we've had some wonderful times. Most of those, I've shared a good bit of that. We also had some very difficult times, and I sort of want to wind down to this sort of thing. I can relate totally to what Kevin was saying last night in talking about the automobile accident his mother and I had. It was a very serious one. Some of you in this room know the kind of support and love that you gave to us during the period of time while we were going through the recovery process. And Kevin's participation in getting his mother to the point where she could get home out of that hospital, he doesn't need to downplay it because it was very real. We were in a very small hospital, a very good hospital, over in West Alabama. We only had one nurse in there who was any problem at all, and it was a male nurse who was in charge in the intensive care unit. And I'm forever grateful that he responded real well to some things Kevin said to him, else I think we might have been visiting Kevin at the Tuscaloosa County Jail because he was real upset because he didn't like the way some of the things were going in taking care of his mother. I have to digress here just a minute on this because I think it is meaningful. Virginia hit the windshield and the dashboard of the car, took a big bite out of it, as a matter of fact, and she crushed all these bones in here, and you wouldn't know it today. As a matter of fact, she had a little overbite that she'd always had. The fellow who did the work to repair did it all from inside, incidentally, and left her with no scars. But he was real worried after it was over. He said to her, did you have an overbite? And she said, well, yeah, I had a fairly good overbite. And he said, well, I sure am glad because you hadn't got much of one now. But he said, I thought maybe if you didn't have any at all, I really had screwed up. I accused her of just getting a facelift out of it. But he was extremely good. And then she broke both arms, both wrists right there. The fellow who repaired her turned out to have been a classmate in med school of our oldest son, was also a member of the football team at the University of Alabama, and he is today and was then their team physician. So you think somebody wasn't looking out for us when he put all those bones back together? He gave her choice. He had that was colored casts were just getting out, and he told her, he said, I'll give you pink or blue, or one pink or one blue, whichever you want. She ended up with two hot pink casts running from here to here. Of course, she wasn't able to do very much for herself, so she was staying at home with me. I'd get her sort of lined up where she could move around in the house during the daytime and get her some things fixed that she could hold, manage to get her hands around to eat and drink and what have you, and I'd go on to work. But she couldn't exist really without me. I had to take care of her. So during the midst of all this, we had a meeting coming up in Atlanta, a pretty big one, and I really had to attend. We talked about it and said, well, there's not much choice. You got to go to Atlanta with me to this meeting. As luck would have it, she had a hot pink dress that had exactly matched those two hot pink casts she had. We go to this meeting in Atlanta, and they had some pretty important dignitaries there from Washington and other places. I don't think anybody knew whether they were there or not. We walked in the door. I introduced her around to a few people. She disappeared, and every time I looked the rest of the night, she was surrounded by about 15, 20 people over in various parts of the room that we were in. But we had a good time. But the love and support that came through then to us was tremendously important, and I'll never forget it. People in here, how grateful I am that I had the opportunity to be with you. I'm going to close with this, and this was going to be my closing today regardless, and I promise you, Kevin and I had not talked before last night about what he was going to say, but I'd already planned this. It's not something that y'all hadn't heard before, I'm sure, but when he talked about the tools that he felt we gave him when he was growing up, this is one of my favorite poems, and as I said, I'm sure you've heard it before, but it was written by a fellow named Ariel Sharp. And it goes like this. Isn't it strange that princes and kings and clowns that caper in sawdust rings and common folk like you and me are builders for eternity? To each is given a bag of tools, a shapeless mass, and a book of rules. And each must make, ere life is flown, a stumbling block or a stepping stone. I'm glad to be with you and be with some stepping stone builders. Thank you so much for having me.